from the Venetian Pool of Coral Gables to the maritime life-saving stations of Jupiter, centennials are busting out all over South Florida in 2025 and 2026. Welcome to a special holiday edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at WLRN's fascinating series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. Its reports take us back to the epic real estate boom of the 1920s, which spawned city charters up and down our coast. The stories are captivating. Was Al Capone a founding father of Deerfield Beach? Why did all those pink flamingos stay in Hialeah? And how did Boca Raton become a reverse north-to-south black migration magnet? All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bemvindo. We hope you're enjoying the holidays, and because it is the holidays, we wanted to devote this program to a look at the fascinating series WLRN has been airing called History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida. Its reports take us back to this region's epic real estate boom of the 1920s, a land rush that spawned city charters up and down our coast, from Coral Gables to Jupiter. As a result, we celebrated a slew of local centennials in 2025 and we're hailing more in 2026. The stories behind those foundings are engaging and inspiring. Did you know Bahamians built Coral Gables' iconic Venetian Pool? Or that Jupiter played a key role in the Spanish-American War? Do you know how Hialeah and pink flamingos became synonymous? Or how Boca Raton's historic Pearl City neighborhood sparked a black migration wave not from south to north, but from north to south? Embracing these histories is critical for this corner of America, which too often feels as though it has no history. I'm joined now by WLRN's government accountability reporter, Joshua Ceballos, who headed the History We Call Home series. Josh, how are you?
I'm doing great, Tim.
Josh, let's remind folks that between 1920 and 1925, the populations of Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties doubled or even tripled. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we so often cite the real estate boom, but I think a lot of South Floridians aren't aware of some of the key causes of that boom, one of which, as you point out in the first installment of History We Call Home, was the role of soldiers and World War I, right? Tell us about that and some of the other big reasons for this stunning growth at that period.
That's right. So during World War I, the U.S. really needed to ship out agricultural products, food, to help the war effort, sending these over to, you know, the front lines over in Europe. And so it needed a place to grow those fruits and vegetables and all those staple goods. And South Florida
year round.
Yeah. So South Florida was a perfect place because, you know, it's always sunny here. The ground is fertile. So they started building all of these military bases down here where they could build this agriculture. After the war was over, many of these soldiers who were stationed here were like, well, this is actually a great place to settle down. Mm-hmm. And now I can settle down, and there are these, a lot of young soldiers at the time were creating families here. That mixed, I think, with the railroad, as we'll get into later with Henry Flagler, right, along with the expansion of roads and highways and the proliferation of the automobile. All of these things made it so that people could move across the country. And there was great wealth at this time, obviously before the Great Depression, where there was, you know, the Roaring Twenties.
Roaring Twenties, the jazz age, yeah.
And so folks had more disposable income that they could use to buy property. They were looking for places to homestead, and this was the spot.
And that, of course, led to the creation of a dozen South Florida cities almost overnight, as your report emphasizes. What were these new cities, and how did they all get chartered so quickly?
Yeah, so there's a dozen cities in Miami-Dade County. There's Hialeah and Coral Gables, and in Palm Beach County we've got Jupiter and Boca Raton. And all of these cities were popping up seemingly overnight between this period of 1925 and 1926, which is actually towards the end of the Great Florida Land Boom, which everyone sees the closing chapter of that land boom being the Great Hurricane of 1926, although some historians believe it was already ending by that time. Mm-hmm. And they were able to charter so quick because of so much real estate investment. And in a lot of these cities, you had these wealthy entrepreneurs who were landowners, and they would bring in people from the north to come in and survey their land and buy a property.
That's interesting. Chartering then facilitated more real estate purchasing.
Right. It's kind of
a reason why a lot of villages and cities charter themselves today in South Florida.
Right. So it's sort of a loop where it started with unchartered land that these moguls were bringing in people to buy up land. And then those people would get together and charter a town, charter a village, charter a city.
Yeah.
And then it would grow and grow and grow from there.
Now, here's some interesting city promotional ads you found in your reporting. Let's take a quick listen.
Coral Gables, a name later given to the city itself by son George when he founded it in 1925.
Welcome to Florida's Hollywood, founded in the 1920s to be a dream city by the sea.
So Boca, 100 years coming up, right?
So Josh, why then a century later did you and WLRN feel it was important to explore what I guess we could call the origin story of South Florida? Why is history we call home a project that you especially felt compelled to take on as a journalist?
Yes, look, I was born and raised in South Florida in Miami-Dade County, and I never really learned local history in school. That was not something that was ever taught.
Good point, yeah.
We learned about national and international history, but I didn't know about the city that I went to school in and how it was started 100 years ago by Glenn Curtis. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any of these things. And I think it was around 2020 in the pandemic that I felt I needed to connect more with my history and with my local history. So I started to learn and get into that. And it was last year that I started to notice, along with some of my colleagues, that there were so many cities turning 100. And we saw this as a perfect opportunity to highlight this. And we felt like WLRN was the outlet that needed to be doing this to celebrate our community.
I agree. And now that the series has been airing for almost a year, what sort of results are you and WLRN seeing in terms of local reaction to history that, let's face it, a notoriously transient population like South Florida's probably wasn't all that aware of?
Yeah, we've witnessed a great reaction. We've had the opportunity to be on the Miami History Podcast. We partnered with History Miami Museum to be part of their Boomtown series. We've also been working with the Miami-Dade County Heritage Trust in part of their historic preservation magazine publishing. We're going to be doing some work with them. So we've really seen an outpouring of support for this because I think people recognize the importance of local history and educating people. And listen, I like to joke, my friends as well, they all were born and raised here in South Florida, and they don't know anything. They don't know anything about South Florida, what city they're in or anything. And so this is my way of sharing my love for local history with everybody. And I think there's been a really great outpouring of support for
that. It's great that it's resonating that way. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. He heads up the WLRN series, History We Call Home, on the raft of city centennials we're celebrating across South Florida. Josh, many thanks and congrats on this fascinating project. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'd like to now welcome WLRN senior producer Sherry Lynn Cabrera to continue discussing the History We Call Home stories we've been talking about. This one is on the city of Hialeah Centennial and its famous pink flamingos. Sherry, let's start with the horse racing track and the pink flamingos, which you report were brought here in part to, well, make the French jealous. Tell us that story and how the track and the birds would go on to draw celebrity visitors here like Winston Churchill.
Yeah, so this all goes back to 1930 when a man named Joseph Widener, this really wealthy horse breeder who had just bought and rebuilt the racetrack after it was completely destroyed by the Great Miami Hurricane of 1926. So he had traveled all over the world and was especially inspired by the Longchamp racecourse. So this gorgeous racecourse in Paris that everyone said was the most beautiful in the world. But Widener, he wanted to take things a step further. He came up with this wild idea to bring in pink flamingos. And so he built a habitat for them, literally right in the middle of the racetrack, and shipped in about 20 flamingos from Cuba in 1934.
Oh, that's now, where they're from. Okay.
Yes. Cool. Well, now, the funny part is, by the next morning, the birds had all flown away, and they forgot to clip their wings. But Widener tried again a few years later. This time, they clipped their wings, and eventually, the flamingos started nesting and raising babies right there on the track. Over time, the flamingos just stayed, and there was no need to clip their wings anymore. But the flamingos ended up being a huge attraction. The combination of elegant horse racing, and then you add in these bright pink birds. Mm-hmm. Hialeah Park was the place to be. Thousands of people would show up, and even big names like Winston Churchill.
Thanks, Sherry. Let's now listen to that piece we have been discussing, which you and WLRN's Helen Acevedo did together about the racetrack and those pink flamingos.
And they're off! Heir to the throne is awake.
The Hialeah Park racetrack isn't just a historic landmark for the city.
By Alexander, Dr. Cotter is away quickly, and in between horses, time for a change.
It's what put the city of Hialeah on the map for people across the world.
This year is Hialeah's centennial, and 100 years ago, the racetrack was at the center of things. Now, it's trying to catch up with the city of progress. This story is part of our series, History We Call Home. In its heyday, some big names flocked to the racetrack, from the Kennedys to Sir Winston Churchill. Today, some local celebrities still hang around.
A flock of pink flamingos.
I have a long history with flamingos.
Ken Wild is with the Miami Springs Historical Society.
Julius Barber used to feed the flamingos when I worked there at Hialeah Racetrack. And every once in a while, I'd help him mix the food for the flamingos, and he would feed them every day.
Wild says he recalls the birds having a diet of shrimp and rice. He was fresh out of high school when he started working at the Hialeah Racetrack in 1963. He had every kind of job you can imagine, from a landscaper to a plumbing assistant. He was even part of the team that installed the aluminum canopy that still hovers over the stands today.
Wild's fond memories at the racetrack over the years are what keep him coming back at 79 years old. We got to tour the grounds with Wild one hot summer morning recently.
And you can see the flamingos through the trees out here.
Yeah. Wild was dressed for the occasion, wearing a bright pink button-up covered in flamingos. The track has become a place of tranquility and nostalgia for Wild. The racetrack and its grandstand sit mostly empty today, but it was once the most popular place in town. In the early 1920s, aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis and Missouri cattleman James Bright provided acres of land to develop the city. The two men are known as the co-founders of Hialeah. In 1922, the track opened as the first greyhound dog racing track in the country. 3 years later, it transitioned to the Miami Jockey Club and added horse racing. Then, there was a wooden clubhouse and grandstand, 21 horse stables, and one of the largest roller coasters at the time. It was also where the first Hialeah Fronton in the Miami area was located.
They wanted to attract people to the town. And it attracted thousands of people every night. They had busloads of people coming from downtown Miami and all around Miami.
Then the Miami hurricane of 1926 devastated South Florida.
The Hialeah Fronton was demolished. The roller coaster and amusement park was demolished. And most of the homes in Hialeah were demolished.
The racetrack was shut down for more than 5 years. That was until Joseph Widener took the reins. He owned Belmont Park on Long Island and was a wealthy thoroughbred horse breeder. He reopened it as the Hialeah Park Racetrack.
In 32 is when he restored it to what it looks like now.
Yeah.
He spent millions of dollars. He had traveled all around the world, and there's a famous track, I believe it's in France, called Longchamps. And that was supposed to be the most beautiful track in the world. And then he visited that and fashioned Hialeah Racetrack after Longchamps.
But Widener wanted more, something no one at the time had seen before. So in 1934, he imported the first flock of flamingos from Cuba. Widener constructed a habitat for the birds in the middle of the racetrack with a lake and four islands.
He brought, I think it was 14 initially, put them at near the infield lake. The next day, they were all gone. And because they didn't clip their wings, I didn't think they were going to fly away. The next batch they brought, they clipped their wings, and they didn't fly away for many years. At some point, they stopped clipping their wings, and they didn't fly away anymore. And they started having babies.
One of the most popular events was Flamingo Day, when flamingos raced on the track.
A visit to Hialeah Park is well worthwhile, even if the horses aren't running. Its colorful flamingos are a popular attraction the year round.
Over time, the flamingo became a symbol for the racetrack and the city of Hialeah. It's seen across the city, from the Hialeah Fountain on East 8th Avenue to the city logo. And it even inspired the logo of the Florida Lottery in 1986. At one point, Hialeah Park had more than 300 flamingos. A 2023 count found 96 flamingos still living on the track. The Hialeah Racetrack flamingos were credited for helping zoos develop sustainable populations of American flamingos outside of the wild.
Hialeah Park Racetrack has been run by the Brunetti family since the 70s. A change in state law in 2001 made it harder to compete with other racetracks like Gulfstream Park in Hallandale. And because of this, Hialeah Racetrack saw a steep decline in races and eventually ceased operations. The last thoroughbred horse race was in 2001.
Okay, so right now we're standing in the grandstand. You see old photos of some races from back in the day. But looking at the track, you can see kind of like the outline of the track. At the far right from where we're standing, you just see a group of flamingos. They look like little pink dots. And then in the background, you just see townhomes and a Leon Medical Center. You see Hialeah Hospital in the distance. But there's flamingos right there.
The racetrack is really intact, except for the fact that grass is overgrown on it, but like everything looks like it's been kept as is forever.
The Brunetti family rebranded as Hialeah Park Casino in 2013. They transformed what used to be the North Grandstand into a casino to keep a revenue source.
The track itself and the clubhouse and the grandstand and the paddock area are all historically protected areas, and that is beautiful.
In recent years, Hialeah Park has gotten permission from the city council to develop its vacant space. Construction is underway for more than 300 homes and a charter school.
If that's what it takes to pay the bills and keep that place open, I don't fault them.
Through all the changes in the last 100 years of the track, one thing still stands with a natural elegance like no other, the pink flamingo.
This story contains audio from the Hialeah Park Casino and Miami-Dade College's Wolfson Archives.
Helen Acevedo is WLRN's afternoon anchor. Sherilyn Cabrera is our senior producer. I will be right back with more discussion of WLRN's series, History We Call Home. Still to come, the Bahamians who built the Venetian Pool and the school that helped create Davie. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're devoting today's holiday program to a look at WLRN's fascinating series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida, about the raft of local centennials we're celebrating in 2025 and 2026, a century after the region's epic land boom sparked a boom of city charters. In our last segment, we discussed Hialeah history. Now we want to turn to Coral Gables. WLRN's South Florida Roundup producer, Jimena Romero, tells us about the folks who built the city's iconic Venetian Pool.
On a hot afternoon, the Venetian Pool in Coral Gables was full of little kids, swimming under the waterfall and into a cave. Their parents sunbathed nearby under lush palm trees. The 60,000 square foot structure, with two towers and a bridge, is built from coral rock in Mediterranean Revival style. Before it became one of South Florida's most iconic tourist attractions, it was an eyesore. The site was originally a coral rock quarry. Bohemian workers removed a lot of the rock for buildings in the city. What was left was a pit that wasn't very attractive to potential home buyers. The solution transformed the pit into a pool.
Very cool thing about the Venetian pool, not much has actually changed of how it looked 100 years ago to what it looks like today. And that's the beauty of preservation, making sure that we comply with any restoration projects to make sure we don't alter the original look from the 1920s.
Carolina Vester is Coral Gables Assistant City Manager. She started her career about 20 years ago as a lifeguard at the pool. And later, she was the pool's manager.
Few things have changed over the years, like the diving board on the waterfall, just because we can't have people diving off a 10-foot diving board on top of a rock structure into 8 feet of water.
It first opened in 1924, a year before the city was incorporated, then known as Venetian Casino. The pool quickly became a place for entertainment, beauty contests, poolside dance performances, aquatic shows.
Jackie Ott, the Aquatot, he was a famous entertainer, so he used to, you know, dress up in different roles, entertain the public, spectators, jump through fire hoops.
It would often also become a makeshift amphitheater, where opera singers and orchestras performed, sometimes in the water with their instruments, sometimes at the bottom of the drained pool. This is the Miami Symphony Orchestra playing on the pool floor for the city's 90th anniversary. Many locals know little about the Bahamian people who quarried the rock to build Coral Gables. Some of the structures they built are on the National Registry of Historic Places, including the Venetian pool itself.
As laborers, they built churches and the residences and the hotels and the businesses for Coral Gables, the city beautiful.
Dorothy Jenkins Fields is a Bohemian descendant and founder of the Black Archives Foundation.
I'm always so proud to be able to say that because we were a big part of making it beautiful, not only with the construction, but also with the gardens and the landscaping.
Bohemian farmers traveled seasonally to the region to work crops in the early 1900s. By the 1920s, their labor became essential to the local economy. Marvin Dunn, a retired local historian, says white settlers weren't familiar with local materials.
These early pioneers knew how to use lumber to construct buildings, but they had no idea of how to deal with coral rock, which is the foundation of South Florida. And the Bahamians knew because they have the same soil in the Bahamas.
Dunn says these workers faced exploitation and unsafe working conditions.
There were no protections against accidents or injuries. Some people in the course of building Coconut Grove and Coral Gables died in accidents, no compensation. And the amount of pay was barely above the level to sustain a family.
Because of racial segregation, some of these same workers also faced displacement.
When the University of Miami was established, they didn't have room for dormitories. So there was a black settlement where the University of Miami now is, just west of the highway, that was occupied by Merrick workers. And the University of Miami wanted that land. So what they worked out, and Merrick was at the center of this, was to have those people move from that area in Coral Gables across US 1 to an area that's now Golden Gate, the McFarland section.
As I understand it, in the mornings, they would work for George Merrick. And in the afternoons, they would come and they would build their homes.
Carleon Prime is president of the Lola B. Walker Homeowners Association, which is working to preserve the history of Golden Gate and McFarland homestead subdivisions. The association worked with the city to install a historic marker at the corner of US 1 and Grant Avenue, which is between these neighborhoods. Prime is a third-generation McFarland homestead resident.
As we just move along, you know, still trying to keep that spirit of community and not lose it. And as long as there's some of us who are alive who can preserve it, we'll do it, and we'll try to find a way to make sure that the next generation understands it and that it's not lost.
McFarland Homestead is home to 36 original houses built over 100 years ago in the Bahamian bungalow and shotgun wood frame styles. All of them have survived despite hurricanes and the test of time. Prime lives in one of the original homes. He pointed out three trees in his yard, one which has been here since his grandfather lived here in the 1930s.
I planted this tree when I was about 10 years old. And this one over here at Iowa College, my father planted that one when he was a boy. So we can tell the family history in the avocado trees in the yard.
Today, many of the residents of both the McFarland Homestead and Golden Gate subdivisions are descendants of the pioneering families. That was WLRN South Florida Roundup producer Jimena Romero. Julia Cooper contributed reporting to that story. Now let's go up north to Davie, a Broward town that too often gets overlooked in South Florida lore. Long before it became known for its horses and rodeos, it was miles of wild, untamed Everglades in the early 1900s. After the wetlands were drained, settlers came looking for new opportunities to farm, to build, to start fresh. Those early pioneers learned to work the land and build a community from the ground up. Up at the center of it all was the Davie School, now known as the Old Davie School Museum. WLRN's education reporter Natalie LaRoche-Pietri takes us inside one of Broward County's earliest school buildings as part of our series, History We Call Home, 100 Years of South Florida.
The original chalkboard is still in the classroom, and it's a little beat up, but some of the writing on it is still legible. Here on the corner it says, reading, writing, and arithmetic, with the R of each word underlined. And there are 24 wooden desks perfectly lined up. And a lot of them still have engravings from the students that used to sit here. This one has MH. Another one says EP and a heart underneath it. The letter A is scribbled nearby. And you can hear the echo of the classroom with just me in here. It makes me really wonder how it would have sounded with a bunch of little kids. Educational Director Kim Wisemantle is leading a tour of fourth graders from Pasadena Lakes Elementary School in Pembroke Pines.
She's wearing her swimsuit, getting ready to jump in, jumping off a bridge, taking a big boat trip together. But who do you have to watch out for when you're in that water?
Alligators.
Alligators and snakes.
I just love when the kids come into the classroom and they're like, whoa! And they just left their own classrooms and now they're here at ours, and it feels so wildly different to them. But it's not, there's still a teacher up front who's, you know, wanting to share information with them. And kids are going to be kids forever. There's, you know, very little difference between that.
The school opened in 1918, the Great Florida Land Boom on the horizon. In its lifetime, the building has served as a meeting place for dances, dinners, elections, and as a shelter during hurricanes and floods. The town of Davie was officially incorporated into Broward County for the first time in 1925, 100 years ago. Exhibits take visitors through the history of building this community, New Florida families coexisting with gators and rattlesnakes, how Griffin Road got its name, and the contribution efforts for World War II. For Wisemantle, the most important thing to her is that she's honest about all of Davie's history. That includes acknowledging the decades of racial segregation.
A lot of the racial struggles here is something we're trying to research too, because a lot of the information that we have doesn't tell that story.
And the forced displacement of the Native American tribes of the area, the Seminoles and Tecumseh.
Everglades pulling their weapons and canoes beside them to remove those Seminoles, but thankfully the Seminoles had scouts out and they were able to report to their group and they were able to escape further west.
I want to be able to share all of the histories that we have here. We're a school, and that's what we're supposed to do. You know, that's what we're here to share the information for the next generation.
Old pictures line the walls of the museum. As Wisemantle leads the tour, she points to some of the people in the photos, those who helped the school thrive in its early days.
Here, Althea Jenny. She taught until her retirement in 1946, so she was one of the original figures here.
And she was like a much beloved teacher. There's always very nice stories about her.
One of those nice stories comes from Edna Hammer Griffin. She moved to Davie in 1927 and attended the Davie School from 1st to 6th grade. She told this story about her teacher, Miss Jenny, in an interview at the 1991 Orange Blossom Festival.
Everyone loved Miss Jenny. She had been at Davie School around 35 years. She had always said she was going to teach until I came back from college and took her place, and it happened that way. She retired in 1946. I graduated from college from FSU, which was Florida State College for Women at that time, in 1946, and in the fall I started teaching at Davie Elementary School. I took Mrs. Jenny's second grade.
She died in 1995 at the age of 74. By the late 70s, the student body outgrew the school. So in 1978, the current Davie Elementary opened its doors for some 700 students, a long way from the 90 students it opened with back in 1918. I had to drive on College Avenue to get there. It's a fitting name for a street surrounded by locations for the University of Florida, Nova Southeastern University, and Florida Atlantic University. There was something symbolic about driving past them on my way to an elementary school, kind of like, to get here, you must first start here. Principal Delicia Collins agreed with me.
We have an amazing partnership with NSU. They're right there. I mean, you can see their field, and they are surrounded by us. They provide so many opportunities for us. We've had several of the students to say, hey, we want a tutor. And so we invited them to open house, and parents were able to sign up with them directly.
Inside Davie Elementary, posters and wall decor encourage student success and motivation. But perhaps the most striking image in one of the main hallways is the mural of the school's mascot, the Mighty Mustang, rearing towards you. And behind it, a giant green horseshoe, a sort of good luck charm.
We try to incorporate Mustang pride in all that we do and remind our students that they are destined for greatness.
Davie Elementary is slightly below enrollment capacity. Still, it has over 600 students, filling almost 90% of the capacity. Other Broward County schools are less than 50% enrolled. This drastic under-enrollment comes at a financial loss for the district, so it's moving forward with a plan to repurpose, consolidate, and even close some of the emptiest schools. Still, Collins wants to see her school continue to grow and thrive.
We have a debate club, we have musical Mustangs, and this year we are adding a chess club, we are adding a robotics club, cheerleading. We are always galloping toward success and galloping to greatness, and we have a school call, so an adult will say Davie, and all of the students will say Mustangs. And that is just a reminder that we are united.
That was WLRN's education reporter, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri. Still to come, History We Call Home looks at Pearl City, the Freedom Tower, and Al Capone's rum running through Deerfield Beach. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. We're looking back today at WLRN's fascinating series called History We Call Home, about the slew of city centennials being celebrated across South Florida in 2025 and 2026. From Coral Gables and the Bahamians who built the iconic Venetian Pool, to Jupiter and its pioneering role as a maritime life-saving station, these reports remind us how much of this subtropical region took shape back in the mid-1920s, when the great real estate boom of that decade spawned municipal charters up and down the coast. Back on July 25th, we spoke with three of the WLRN reporters who brought us these histories. Palm Beach County reporter Wilkin Brutus told us about Boca Raton's historic black neighborhood, Pearl City. Morning Edition producer Amy Galliano, who at that time was Amy Sanchez, joined us to talk about the saga of Miami's iconic downtown Freedom Tower. And Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie filled us in on Deerfield Beach's journey from Al Capone haunt to Broward boomtown. Wilkin Brutus, I want to start with you and your deep dive into one of South Florida's most interesting black communities, the Pearl City neighborhood of Boca Raton. When we talk about black migration a century ago, we usually think of south to north, from states like Georgia to cities like Chicago, for example. You point out that Boca Raton actually benefited from a north-to-south black migration from states like Georgia to Pearl City. Tell us how that played out and how important Pearl City became to the city Boca Raton eventually became.
Yes, it's certainly a story that isn't told often. The Pearl City neighborhood, which was established in 1915, about a decade before Boca Raton's incorporation, was built to house black farm workers who were quite essential to the booming farming industry in early Boca Raton. And so this was part of a wave of black, white, and even Japanese folks who migrated to the area in the late 19th and early 20th centuries for better pay in farming. Mm-hmm. And so Pearl City had its own black family-run businesses because it had to during the Jim Crow era.
Right. And Pearl City, though, I mean, I gather from your report very vividly that Pearl City, you know, wasn't just an important historic black community. It was an important community in terms of developing Boca Raton itself, no?
Oh, absolutely. Some of the stories itself describes folks who had spent time in the military.
Right.
There was a military base. Black folks were very much involved in that. The community itself had juke joints and restaurants and grocery stores. Definitely part of the early development of Boca Raton. So you can't really describe the early parts of Boca Raton without Pearl City, primarily because of its early influences.
Now, of course, Pearl City's residents had to face the harsh realities of segregation. And I want to play a clip here of a woman you interviewed, Marie Hester, who remembers those days.
Like, you can't go to this place or that place. Blacks have to go through the back door. When you go to the grocery store, make sure just to drink out of the black water fountain. I was never told why either. Most of the pioneers did not tell you why. They just would say, you do what I tell you to do, and this could save your life.
Wilkin, just briefly, tell us about Pearl City today, a century after it overcame those Jim Crow days in South Florida.
I want to say Marie Hester's mom is 96 years old, so it was an absolute pleasure speaking with these women who are in their 70s and 80s. And so while some descendants like Mary, Marie Hester, have returned and remodeled their ancestral homes, typical migration patterns, gradual integration and gentrification led many black residents to move away. But the neighborhood's legacy lives on through its remaining two historic churches, many preserved homes, and community spirit, because, you know, Boca economy is now driven by finance, tech, and healthcare rather than farming. Mm-hmm. And so the neighborhood still has its community spirit because there's all sorts of events catering towards Pearl City.
Amy, you gave us a compelling centennial history of the Freedom Tower in downtown Miami. Walk us briefly through what the Freedom Tower originally was and the inspiring Miami Statue of Liberty, as one source calls it, that it later became.
Yeah, so the Freedom Tower first opened in 1925, and it served as the headquarters for the newspaper, the Miami Daily News and Metropolis. Mm-hmm. But then that newspaper moved out 3 decades later, and essentially the tower was left without an owner and really without purpose. But then the federal government in 1962 turned the tower, or the building at that time, into a processing center.
And it became a processing center because of...
It became a processing center because of the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that were fleeing the communist revolution. And so at that processing center, they received financial aid and food, medical care. And they also found out about different job opportunities that, yeah. they were also offering.
Now, you, of course, had some moving interviews with people, particularly Cubans escaping communism back in Cuba, about their transit through Freedom Tower to a new and more hopeful life in Miami and America. And one of them was Luis Serrano, who described to you how he just barely made it out back in 1967.
I was born in the city of Camagüey, which is towards the east of Cuba, where the big belly of the island is. I'm the son of a housewife and a doctor, so we had a comfortable life. In the summer, between 8th and 9th grade, during my vacation, we received the notification that we were going to be allowed to leave Cuba, and I left Cuba in August 30th of 1967. Cuba had a policy, the communist government had a policy, that if a male was between the ages of 15 and 27, they could not leave the country because that was considered military age. And so if we had not left when we did, when I was 14 and a half years old, we would have had to stay in Cuba because they would not have allowed me to leave.
Amy, what was your sense then of what the Freedom Tower means to people in Miami like Luis Serrano?
Honestly, a lot from what I gathered from people that I spoke with, it's just that the Freedom Tower means exactly what the name says. It means freedom for them.
Yeah.
It was this opportunity to be able to come to a new place and build a life that they didn't see for themselves in Cuba. And so it speaks a little bit about their bravery and their courage for coming to a new place. And that's something that Luis mentioned as well when I was speaking with him. He said that he loved the fact that they treated him so well when he came, because you don't know what can happen when you take the risk and you go to another country to start a new life. And so I think for people that I spoke with, it means hope and freedom and this chance at a better and new life.
Right. Miami Statue of Liberty. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus, Amy Galliano, and Carlton Gillespie about their reports for our series, History We Call Home. They're telling us about the centennials of Boca Raton, Miami's Freedom Tower, and Deerfield Beach. Carlton Gillespie, I was, of course, taken by your history of Deerfield Beach, not least of which because it has an Al Capone connection. I want to play a clip here from your interview with Jeff Fisk, a member of the Deerfield Beach Historical Society, who sort of sums up why the iconic gangster Capone ditched Miami and came north to Broward.
He was getting harassed so much in Miami that as soon as he would cross into the city limits, if a police car saw his vehicle, they would pull him over. They would make up something. He was getting pretty hot down there, so he was looking for a place that no one would bother him.
And Carlton, you report that a lot of that also had to do with the role the Hillsborough River played in the rum-running days of Prohibition a century ago. Tell us more about that.
Right. The Hillsborough River was dredged out by the Army Corps of Engineers it happened to a number of these kind of inland rivers down in South Florida, but it was dredged in a straight line almost all the way to the Okeechobee Canal. So
yeah.
It was easy to kind of float something down the river and transport it out. And Capone specifically, it's like a movie scene. He had a fish packing house right on the mouth of the river, right where the Intracoastal is. They would put the booze in a false bottom, put the false bottom on top, cover it with dry ice, pack it with fish, and send it off either to the railroad in the center of town in Deerfield or up the river to ship it out. There was a ton of rum running in the operation area.
Your fish would have mercury and cane alcohol.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, there was a famous restaurant in nearby what's now nearby Lighthouse Point called Cap's Place that opened in 1928. And, Cap Knight, the owner, was a notorious law flouter and rum runner, and there would be just barrels they'd mark barrels and float them up the river, and then they'd get picked up and the cash would get dropped at a later date. I mean, it was prevalent in this part of the county. It was really a lot of fun to uncover.
But obviously Deerfield Beach has moved beyond that portrait of itself from Prohibition to the modern and developed Broward County showcase it is today. But do folks there still embrace that colorful history to some extent?
You know, there was in Capone's old fish packing house, it was replaced with a place called the Riverview Restaurant. And that restaurant had some of the old gambling paraphernalia that was left behind by Capone kind of up on the walls until it was shut down. But no, I think in general, they don't. I mean, I'm from Northern Broward and I knew none of this. In fact, this whole story got kicked off. I was driving a couple of friends down Hillsborough Boulevard, and I pointed out the Butler House and said, I'm way behind the eight ball in this story. I've got to do mm-hmm. something. And they said, we got to call your friend County. And my friend County Price, turns out he's the great, great, great grandson of George Emery Butler, the town's first mayor. Right. I had no idea.
Right.
So that certainly made sourcing a lot easier. But I think people just kind of don't realize the history that's beneath their feet.
Right.
A lot of times. That's why I think the series is so great.
Which brings me to the last question I want to ask all three of you. How this WLRN History We Call Home series perhaps gave you guys, yourselves, a greater appreciation of the history that exists here in a region that frankly has a reputation for not having much history. Wilken?
Yeah, you know, WLRN listeners throughout the years have engaged with many of my profiles about ethnic enclaves, whether it's the Hungarians or Finnish or indigenous Guatemalans, in this case, Black Americans in Pearl City. And so these stories about human migration and community often get swept under our historical lens. And so History We Call Home helps to reintroduce those voices beyond the Florida man tropes.
Yeah, I mean, and you, Wilken, you also reported on Jupiter and how lighthouses, for example, you know, really helped make South Florida, you know, not just an outlier or backwater, but an urban center.
Absolutely. You can't talk about Palm Beach County's history without its lighthouse. And yeah. So it also reintroduces folks in South Florida about the various histories within South Florida itself.
Amy, what about you?
Absolutely. It makes me have a greater appreciation because I myself took pictures at the Freedom Tower when I was a little girl, and I didn't know the history that I was basically standing in front of. And so it was really, really cool to also find out about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and tell us about your own personal family history.
I'm Brazilian, but my parents are Ecuadorian, and so I came here to the U.S. to live here when I was 9 years old. And so that's when I went and I took a picture at the Freedom Tower in front of Bayside. And it was really cool to be able to learn about the place that I now call home.
Right. Carlton.
Well, there are, I push back. I would say there are people that are dedicated in preserving this history. We heard from Jeff Fisk earlier for my story. I mean, there are people out there who want to leave these things intact and protected. And I want to echo something Timothy Butler said in my story. He said, of his late grandfather, he always told me, you're going to want to ask us more questions because when I'm gone, there's going to be nobody else who remembers. So that's what I would encourage people to do in their communities and keep this history alive.
But let me ask you just real quickly then in 10 seconds here. Again, do Deerfield Beach people, maybe perhaps as a result of your report, suddenly see a history that they never knew before?
That's certainly the response I've gotten from people.
Uh-huh.
I mean, plenty of people have said, oh, I had no idea this was going on. I grew up on this street. I mean, it's been a great response.
That was WLRN's Carlton Gillespie, Amy Galliano, and Wilken Brutus discussing the centennials of Deerfield Beach, Miami's Freedom Tower, and Boca Raton's Pearl City. Finally on the roundup, the centennial celebrations of South Florida cities are certainly not over, nor is our series highlighting the rich histories behind them. In 2026, a handful of more cities will be marking their 100th birthdays. The City of North Miami Centennial is coming up on February 5th, marking 100 years since developers Earl Irons and Arthur Griffin voted to incorporate it as the town of Miami Shores, not to be confused with the Village of Miami Shores. North Miami, by the way, will celebrate with a carnival that day. Opa-locka, which was the vision of aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis, will turn a century old on May 14th. It was chartered as a town in 1926 by only 28 registered voters. Also built by Curtis, Miami Springs will have its 100th birthday on August 23rd. The city is counting down the days on its website to kick off a series of centennial events. Miami Springs is shining a spotlight on its founder, who was at one time known as the fastest man on earth after beating the land speed record on his custom motorcycle. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. To close us out this week, here's a song by the California Ramblers inspired by the beginning of the city of Coral Gables. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateus Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz.
I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.